The mysteries of the unknown, UFOs, alien abductions, wonders of the world, ancient archaeology, ghosts, apparitions, secret military projects, futuristic science, government cover-ups, hoaxes and frauds. Join us as we embark on another edition of the Paranet Continuum. Now, answering questions and questioning answers, here's your host, the Director of Paranet Information Services, Michael Corbin.
Good evening and welcome to this edition of the Paranet Continuum, home of common sense, no-nonsense paranormal talk radio. Well, as I promised last week on the program, we have an ongoing investigation that's very interesting, and it's evolving into even more interesting proportions. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tonight, and we also have a guest that will join us later in the hour. This is a very interesting story, by the way, too. She is the one of the most prominent women in the world of aerospace engineering. She's now the manager of the Mars Exploration Program at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She also headed the team that designed the micro rover Sojourner, the revolutionary robot that broadcast from Mars last summer. She'll be joining us later in the hour. Her name is Donna Shirley. She has published a book called Managing Martians, and it's the extraordinary story of a woman's lifelong quest to get to Mars and the team behind the space robot that has captured the imagination of the world. It's going to be a very interesting interview with Donna Shirley later on in the hour, as I told you, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But last week, we told you about an investigation that we were conducting based upon a phone call that I had received on the night of August the 31st. Concerning some unusual lights and sightings down in the Denver area, Denver metro area, and subsequently what appeared to be a military base that went on some kind of alert possibly and chased those objects with an F-16. We're going to talk about that tonight, and without further ado, what I want to do is we've got a couple of people in the studio with us tonight that are going to talk about what they saw. And then we're going to talk about what has progressed in this investigation. It has taken on some kind of unusual proportions, and I want to relate that to you. So we'll get to that first. And if you want to call in, you can call in at 1-800-836-2009. That number again is 1-800-836-2009. And I would like to put out the appeal to anyone who may have further information on this to please give us a call. Either on the air or off the air, and we're going to spend a little bit of time with this again, as I said. But anybody else who has information should be giving us a call again at that number, 1-800-836-2009. And if you want to talk to me privately off air, you can call me at 303-863-0484. Now, to my guests in studio, now, to protect the integrity of the investigation, and of course, one of the requirements that they go on the air was that we would not use their real names. So I'm going to introduce in the studio with me tonight Dave and Donna. And without further ado, I want to thank them for being here. Thank you for being here. Good evening, guys, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, let's talk about this, what happened on August the 31st. One of the two of you can relate the story.
Okay, it was Monday evening, August 31st. We were sitting outside on the deck at it was about 8:30, 8:45. Donna was talking on the phone, and I had noticed in the corner of my eye, a series of lights just kind of blinking. I did a double take, and when I looked at them, it was strange. These were strobe lights, kind of just sitting there and strobing. They weren't moving. They weren't just strobing. All of a sudden, several other lights came on, probably between 5 and 7 lights, continually strobing. And then they formed into a circle and started moving in a circle. The whole time, the lights were just strobing. And suddenly, several of them departed, and 3 took off to the northwest. And it was I can't say how fast they were moving, but they just took off to the northwest.
Were they, two of them, did they go at a high rate of speed?
Very high rate of speed.
Okay.
And two of them went out, and one just continued going, and I followed it until it passed the roof line, at which time I couldn't see it anymore. And that was the time when I called you, Michael. And as a matter of fact, as we were on the phone, you could hear the jets taking off from the airbase.
Right, I could hear that on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they were moving awfully fast, and the noise was, it was killing my ears, actually. And there were two F-16s, actually, and they just they took off chasing whatever light it was that we saw.
Okay. Now, did you hear any sound or anything with that, either one of you?
Not a sound. Nothing.
No.
Okay, Donna, what you want to add something to that? Go ahead.
No, just didn't hear anything.
You didn't hear anything?
No.
Now, first of all, let's go back to this. Obviously, what you guys saw is unusual to you.
Very strange.
And in what way was it strange?
I'd never seen anything like it.
And
nothing like it. I don't. I'm a skeptic. I don't believe in aliens. I don't believe in. I'm just a skeptic. I'm an average Joe.
And what about you, Donna?
And I don't believe in it either.
You don't?
No.
Not at all. What do you think you saw?
Not something that we could have obviously ever crafted to fly.
What was it about the behavior of the lights that makes you feel that way?
The strobing was almost like fireflies, but they were larger than stars, smaller than a jet light, and then they joined, as Dave said, in a circular fashion around. But there was no mass.
There was no.
It was wild. There was no structure. Nothing. There. There was just lights. Now, you could see the clouds in between the lights. There was no fixed anything between them.
Uh-huh.
Just lights strobing. It was the strangest thing. I'd never seen anything like it. No noise. Lights.
How far would you say they were away from you? Do you have any estimate of distance or anything?
3 miles.
Yeah, 2-3 miles. Not very far at all.
Mm-hmm. And at times you did say at times they were stationary.
When I first noticed it, they were stationary. And several other, there were three lights when I had first noticed it.
Okay.
And then several others had blinked on. And that's when I told Donna, you know, I asked her, do you see the same thing I see, or is there something wrong with me?
Yeah.
And she did.
Now, as we reported last week, I saw the F-16s through the binoculars make the distance. And by the way, the base is Buckley Air National Guard Base, which is in Aurora, and this sighting occurred in the Aurora area. I saw those jets make the distance between Buckley and the mountain range, which is a considerable distance, in under 1 minute. And they appeared to be going extremely fast. And now, basically, what was your feeling about, you know, what the jets were doing?
My only assumption was they were chasing whatever it was that I saw. They moved in the same direction.
I agree. There was no other explanation. It was directly afterwards, came around south around the house and just headed north.
And headed north.
Mm-hmm.
And the jets were right on it, right after it.
Right after. There.
Yeah. You've never seen anything like this before, have you?
Never. No.
No. No. No. No. As a matter of fact, the family's laughing.
Oh, really?
Oh, sure.
Why?
Sure.
Because you see.
They don't believe me.
They don't believe you. Well, now.
Well, they do, but it's so fantastic that they look at you and say, oh, isn't this fun?
Mike, it's so fantastic. I don't believe me.
Exactly.
Real quick before we go to break. Basically, there were other witnesses as well in your neighborhood, and we don't want to divulge where your neighborhood is, but there were other witnesses neighborhood that saw this.
Yeah.
Yes, there were.
Yes, there were.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, stay with me. We're going to go to break. We'll come back, and I'll report to you out there exactly what has taken place since we first got this report and what we've done with it since that time. Well, the number is 1-800-836-2009, 1-800-836-2009. This is very bizarre, and we have something to talk about as far as something that happened a couple of years ago, and also some very strange things that have developed in the investigation. So stay tuned. I'm Michael Corbin. You're listening to the Paranet Continuum. We'll be right back.
Are you sick and tired of the same old UFO magazines? Paranet has the cure. Continuum. Paranet's quarterly magazine is packed with stories you're not used to seeing in the other magazines. There's a regular series on the need to establish a first contact science, written by a psychologist on the alien abduction phenomenon. You'll find interviews with Paranet's fascinating guests, late breaking news from the worlds of science, ufology, and the paranormal. intriguing discussions from Paranet's news groups on the Internet, and their sighting reports, book reviews, and much more. A subscription to Continuum is only $18 for 4 quarterly issues. Call now to order Continuum at 1-800-UFO-NET-1. That's 1-800-836-6381. MasterCard and Visa accepted. Continuum, Paranet's cure for the UFO blues. Call 1-800-836-6381 and order Continuum today.
Paranet wants you to know. The Paranet Continuum has been on the air for more than 4 years, and we couldn't have done it without your support, so this is our way of saying thanks. If you've been listening for a while, you're familiar with our skeptical believer approach to this whole paranormal business. Yes, there are plenty of very strange things going on that science, government, and a variety of belief systems have trouble explaining, and we're not here to flatly debunk everything. We just don't buy into many of the more popular explanations for these phenomena, and we think some more critical thinking is needed. This makes us very unique in a world where the paranormal seems to be everywhere in the media, on TV, other talk shows, and big-budget movies. And some of the wildest explanations seem to get the most attention. Many people like our approach. Of course, others are mad at us. Oh well. With your continuing support of this radio show, our website, and Continuum magazine, we hope to keep everybody thinking and talking well into the future. Again, thanks. We are Paranet Information Services.
When it comes to UFOs, it's important to keep an open mind, but not as open as, say, a refuse can. We separate the facts from the garbage on the Paranet Continuum. Once again, here's your host, Michael Corbin.
And the number again is 1-800-836-2009. The number again is 1-800-836-2009. Now, we're talking about an incredible story, and we're trying to run it down, of course, because this starts to take on proportions as the same thing that we experienced in Phoenix, Arizona, in March of 98, and that is the Phoenix Lights, or what's known as the Phoenix Lights. Because, as you recall, the Phoenix Lights were also similar in structure. The witnesses did not report any kind of solid craft with the lights, but a configuration of lights that did some unusual things. And, of course, we also heard from Francis Barwood, who was on the program, that military jets chased the Phoenix Lights, as they did here at Buckley. Now, a couple of other things have developed. As I told you last week, we also understood that there were a considerable amount of reports from citizens in the area of Buckley and south west of there, on toward down around Centennial Airport, who had called in numerous complaints of the jets roaring overhead. And, of course, we find out that this is very unusual, this type of activity, because when this report came across, the jets chased after whatever this thing was, there was intense aircraft aerial activity, military aircraft activity, for the next 3 hours, circling around Buckley and around the Aurora area, which I observed myself personally taking place. And, you know, as long as I've been around that area out there, I've never known anything like this to occur this, at this time of night. Again, it was from 8:45 till about 11:15, 11:30 on August 31st. Now, The interesting thing that's developed is that I got a report that there was a cattle mutilation around the area of Brush, Colorado on that same evening. And this was an interesting addition to the investigation, because In 1995, Paranet also investigated a cattle mutilation case in Missouri that had a sighting that was removed from the actual site of the cattle mutilation by about 40 miles. Several people in the town of Trenton, Missouri, including fire department officials and such, observed unusual lights in the sky. And the next morning, in a little town about 40 miles from Trenton, a veterinarian and a rancher discovered a 1,000-pound heifer laying under an elm tree in a few inches of grass with no visible means of how that animal got in or got into that area. But anyway, I have been unable to verify the cattle mutilation case, which is kind of interesting because the information I got, I understand, was broadcast on another program. But we contacted the sheriff's department in two counties, and where there were no reports. We contacted also the local media in one of the towns. And what's interesting about that is that we were told the day that we contacted this this local media outlet that a person from the Department of Energy had been there that morning looking through their archives, looking up cattle mutilation reports that that had happened in that area. And the people that I talked to at the newspaper were absolutely adamant about the fact that this person was from the Department of Energy, but it was not necessarily, he did not identify himself as being there officially. But I found that to be quite interesting that someone from the Department of Energy was there looking into cattle mutilations in that area as well. But anyway, we're continuing this investigation. We're continuing to look at this and try to determine what happened. Now, as I also reported last week, we also have another set of independent witnesses who saw the same configuration of lights, who were located in a different or in a separate location, far removed from these folks. And so, you know, I have no doubt in my mind that the sighting is very legitimate but very unusual, has a lot of elements to it that are very unusual. And we're going to continue to investigate this and try to determine what happened. Also, I want to mention, too, as kind of a sidebar, one of the producers of this program who lives in Loveland, Colorado, on that same night, August the 31st, was outside with his wife, and he observed a commercial jetliner, which apparently where he lives, this is one of the patterns going into the Denver International Airport. He saw a commercial jetliner coming around for a landing and saw a triangular configuration of lights really close to the back of this commercial jet, and this thing was pacing the jet, and it was very, very unusual. And, of course, as my producer has pointed out to me that anytime you have aircraft that are that close together, that apparently is a no-no. So, you know, whatever the heck was following that commercial jetliner is unusual in and of itself. As I've mentioned, we're also looking for any further corroboration of any of the sightings or anything like that. So anyone who may have information, again, can contact me at 303-863-0484. Again, that number is 303-863-0484, and we'll continue to report to you as time goes, as the investigation goes on, what's taking place. Of course, officially, as you probably have guessed, Buckley has stated to us that the jets were up in the air that night on a training maneuver. As they told us, the jets flew out to the western slope of Colorado and into Utah and were doing refueling exercises and testing night vision goggles. However, as I mentioned, that doesn't explain why they were flying around the base for 3 hours. And, of course, they don't know anything about any strange lights. I did find the Centennial Airport as well. There was no corroboration of any unusual lights, just that a lot of people were ticked off by the jet noise that occurred that night. Okay, we're going to go to break. And when we come back, I'll introduce my guest, Donna Shirley. We're going to talk about her book, Managing Martians. Again, it's an extraordinary story of a woman's lifelong quest to get to Mars, and of the team behind the space robot that has captured the imagination of the world. It's quite a story. I think you'll enjoy it. 1-800-836-2009, 1-800-836-2009. I'm Michael Corbin. You're listening to the Paranet Continuum.
Who says you can't get something for nothing? The Paranet catalog contains detailed descriptions of all of the Paranet radio shows produced since April of 1994 and shows you how you can order them on audio cassette for as little as $5 each. Are you on the World Wide Web? You can join Paranet and get access to over 30 megabytes of text files and pictures, as well as real audio access to all of our past radio shows. Members also receive a subscription to Continuum, Paranet's quarterly magazine. The catalog shows you how to join. The Paranet catalog also has special book offers, t-shirts and sweatshirts with alien and outer space themes, and much more. And the catalog is yours free. Call now 1-800-UFO-NET-1. That's 1-800-836-6381 for your free copy of the Paranet catalog. That's 1-800-836-6381.
Paranet has been on the information superhighway since before there was an internet. And during the last 11 years, we've collected an incredible amount of information on UFOs and the paranormal, and you can see all of it on our website. The address is www.paranet.org/paranet. See what Michael Corbin really looks like. Is he a modern-day Orson Welles? Or go to our news page and keep up with the latest happenings in ufology and the paranormal. Click on other interesting sites from our links page. File a UFO sighting report. Read about Continuum magazine. See the Paranet radio studio. Download free pictures of UFOs. Join Paranet online using your Visa or MasterCard. You'll be authorized within minutes to see all 30 megabytes of files and pictures and nearly 200 real audio files of the Paranet Continuum radio shows dating back to April of 1994. You'll find it all at the Paranet website at www.paranet.org/paranet. Talking about the paranormal these days is practically normal, and it doesn't get any better than the Paranet Continuum. Once again, here's your host, Michael Corbin.
The LA Times has described her as this way. I mean, it's very interesting. Her phone number spells Mars, her car is a Saturn, and her home is the closest you can get to a cabin in the sky. Now, Donna Shirley isn't your ordinary earthbound mortal. In fact, for 30 years, she has spent 8 to 18 hours a day planning how to get out of this world and to onto other planets. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program tonight the author of an exciting book called Managing Martians. Now, she is one of the world's best-known aerospace engineers. She's the program manager for the Mars Exploration Program at the California Institute of Technology's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She is the recipient of numerous honors, including NASA's Outstanding Leadership Medal and an induction into the Women in Technology International Hall of Fame. The Mars Exploration Program is currently preparing to launch two Mars Surveyor 98 missions, the next in a series of forthcoming Mars exploration. She's a native of Wynwood, Oklahoma. Shirley lives in La Cañada, California, and has a daughter. And it's my pleasure, again, to welcome to the program tonight Donna Shirley. The book is Managing Martians. And good evening, Donna. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Now, this is an incredible story, I think. It's a very interesting one, and it's not just about going to Mars. It seems to be about other things. Give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what the book Managing Martians is about.
Well, it's an autobiography, so it's about me and what it was like to grow up in Oklahoma wanting to go to Mars. And when I was a kid, I wanted literally to go to Mars.
Uh-huh.
But the best I've been able to do is go virtually. And it took me about 45 years to get there. But last 4th of July, we made it, and it was a very gratifying experience. So the book is about how Pathfinder was done and the trials and tribulations and ups and downs and real-world engineering problems that we faced and
mm-hmm.
real-world political problems that we faced.
Yeah, I was impressed by the fact that this is a very interesting story about not only the process, the logistics and the, you know, the brains that has to go into designing the rover and the things that go there, but it's also a very political game too, isn't it?
It really is. Getting the money to do projects, only one out of every 100 or so that get studied are actually funded.
Uh-huh.
That's the first big step, and then keeping the money and keeping your sponsors happy and getting agreement out of the scientists on what things we're going to do when we get to Mars and so on is all takes a lot of work.
How did you get interested in this?
Well, I always wanted to fly. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a pilot, and I built model airplanes. And then I started reading science fiction and got fascinated with the idea of going into space. But, of course, when I was reading science fiction, no Sputnik hadn't been launched yet. I'm pretty old. And so I started working on aeronautical engineering in college, which was, I thought I was going to be building airplanes, but I ended up building spaceships, which was more fun.
And, of course, I might add, because of the structure of the system, when you started out, it was probably against a lot of odds, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of people who it was at the time, you know, considered not the kind of thing that women did. And there were very few women in that kind of business. And I walked into my advisor's office in college as a freshman in 1958, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to major in aeronautical engineering." And he says, "Girls can't be engineers." But it's come a long way. Now about 15% of the engineers and scientists at JPL are women, whereas when I got there in 1966, I was the only female engineer.
Why did you pick Mars?
Well, I read a book by Arthur C. Clarke called The Sands of Mars when I was about 12, and then I read Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, and I read Heinlein's books about Mars, and just got fascinated with the idea that Mars was this planet that you could envision living on
mm-hmm.
and really exploring, just like the American West. And so I think it was the lure of exploration and adventure and just the fact that here was an unknown, exciting place to go to that I got fascinated with it.
So that's how you got involved with it.
Right.
Now, in your book, you talk about that you consider reaching space to be one of the greatest human endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is out there for us?
Well, I think, number one, adventure and excitement and the frontier, all of those things when you venture out into the unknown. I think the second thing is the learning about ourselves by learning about other planets. So, for instance, the greenhouse effect, the runaway greenhouse effect, was discovered because we flew by Venus and found out that you could melt lead on the surface.
Right.
And we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't gone to Venus. So, and going to Mars, we hope to find out why did Mars go into a permanent ice age billions of years ago when it started out pretty much like the Earth with warm, wet, friendly place.
Well, so I'm taking it then that the general scientific consensus is that Mars at one time was probably a lush, green planet, possibly?
Well, not necessarily green, but it had water, and it was, it was warm enough so that the water was liquid.
Uh-huh.
Now, the big question that we're really working hard on trying to answer is, did life ever get started there? Because life got started on Earth very shortly after Earth cooled enough for there to be liquid water. So, hey, did the same thing happen on Mars? And that's one of the main things we're going there to find out.
What do we know about Mars at the present time?
Well, we know it's a relatively small planet. It's about half the diameter of the Earth.
Uh-huh.
It has 3/8 the gravity, so you could really play basketball like crazy on Mars. And then it also has almost no atmosphere. It is 6 millibars, which means it's less than 1% as thick as our atmosphere at the surface. And it's sort of like being at 130,000 feet on Earth.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's very thin. And it's mostly carbon dioxide.
Uh-huh.
We know Mars has dust storms. It's got this very fine dust that blows all around. We know Mars has had water on the surface because we can see dry riverbeds and craters that look like they had ice in the bottom at one time and features that just are obviously caused by water, at least that sure look like they were caused by water.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that that its atmosphere is thick enough that we can use it to land with. We can use it to slow us down before we hit the ground, which is makes it a lot easier to land there than landing on the moon, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So we know quite a bit about Mars, but what we don't know is what it's really made out of, what the rocks are made out of. We don't know. We know there's giant volcanoes on Mars, but we don't know at what time they were formed and how long ago they were active, for instance. But there's a volcano on Mars that's bigger than the state of Missouri.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty active. It was active in the past. And there's more we don't know about it than we know about it, though.
Now, for the average layperson, which I am and probably a lot of people in the audience, Mars has always held a fascination for a place for possibly, you know, life coming from there, life on that planet, et cetera, et cetera. What is your thought or your feelings about, you know, life, intelligent life out in the universe?
Well, I think there's bound to be life out in the universe. Now, the question of whether it's intelligent or not is harder to answer. I mean, the odds of the only place in this whole big universe being this obscure little remote planet being
right.
the only place that started life, I think, is pretty silly.
Uh-huh.
But now, whether life can become intelligent without destroying itself is, I think, an open question. For instance, the dinosaurs lived for 165 million years without destroying the planet, and we've only been around for about a million years, and already, you know, we're changing the whole climate of the planet. We could be creating a runaway greenhouse effect. We're creating deserts all over the planet. We're deforesting the whole thing. And it may be that intelligent life either fouls its nest, basically ruins its environment, or kills itself off in some sort of genocidal wars.
We're kind of like a work in progress here, right?
Right. So we don't know whether intelligence is a survival characteristic on the big scheme of things or not.
Shouldn't
get too smug.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I kind of want to talk about what the general theories are about how life may evolve.
Okay.
For example, I know I was talking to a friend of mine who's a scientist, and he said something about panspermia is starting to come back into the discussion as possibly a viable theory.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to that when we come back from break. Donna Shirley is my guest. She has written a book called Managing Martians. It's out there on the bookshelves in all major bookstores. It's published by Broadway Books, which is, I think it's, well, it's out of California. It's a big major publisher. But anyway, very interesting story, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. 1-800-836-2009 is our number, 1-800-836-2009. I'm Michael Corbin. This is the Paranet Continuum. Stay tuned.
Paranet wants you to know. Did you know that Paranet Information Services was the first comprehensive paranormal and UFO information service of record? In 1986, Paranet was launched as an electronic news and information service dedicated to answering questions and questioning answers. Since Paranet's launch, we've expanded to a truly global organization linking research and investigative groups via our computer network, now on the Internet. This radio program is a mere extension of the vast knowledge base and experience Paranet has gained through thorough and timely reporting on events throughout the globe. Michael Corbin, Paranet's director, brings 10 years' experience to the Paranet Continuum. This program offers something that others can't and don't, an extensive focus on these issues. To learn more about Paranet, you can contact us toll-free at 1-800-836-6381. Or visit our website at www.paranet.org/paranet.
Are you sick and tired of the same old UFO magazines? Paranet has the cure. Continuum. Paranet's quarterly magazine is packed with stories you're not used to seeing in the other magazines. There's a regular series on the need to establish a first contact science, written by a psychologist on the alien abduction phenomenon. You'll find interviews with Paranet's fascinating guests, late-breaking news from the worlds of science, ufology, and the paranormal, intriguing discussions from Paranet's news groups on the Internet, and their sighting reports, book reviews, and much more. A subscription to Continuum is only $18 for 4 quarterly issues. Call now to order Continuum at 1-800-UFO-NET-1. That's 1-800-836-6381. MasterCard and Visa accepted. Continuum, Paranet's cure for the UFO blues. Call 1-800-836-6381 and order Continuum today.
You're listening to one of the most unusual programs you'll ever hear. It's the Paranet Continuum, and it deals with some of the most fascinating mysteries around. Once again, here's your host, the director of Paranet Information Services, Michael Corbett.
And again, our number is 1-800-836-2009, 1-800-836-2009. We're talking to a very interesting person who has published a book called Managing Martians, and she's manager of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mars Exploration Program, and she is quite a woman, and has done quite a bit. And it's my pleasure again to welcome back to the program Donna Shirley.
Hi, Michael.
Donna, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
What are some of the leading, as I mentioned before the break, we were talking about panspermia.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the leading theories about life and how it might get started out there?
Well, boy, that's a $64,000 question, of course, is how it actually gets started. Carl Sagan did some interesting experiments years ago where he took the elements that were in the atmosphere of Titan, which is the largest moon of the planet Saturn,
uh-huh.
and it's the only moon in the solar system that has an atmosphere, and its atmosphere is full of chemicals that are kind of precursors to life.
Right.
And they tried passing an electric spark through a mixture of stuff that was pretty much what they thought was on Titan,
mm-hmm.
and got some amino acids, which are kind of building blocks of proteins. So one way would just be, hey, there's all these chemicals, and you put energy in them, and zap, you've got life.
Right.
David Baltimore, who's the president of Caltech and a Nobel Prize-winning biologist,
mm-hmm.
said, well, the way life gets started is a bunch of chemicals hang around together, and they've got to be in some sort of solvent, like water.
Mm-hmm.
And then in order for the chemicals to stay close together, they have to be inside something like a layer of grease. And so cells and all living creatures on Earth have a layer of something called lipids, which is basically just a layer of grease, to hold water inside so the chemicals can interact with each other, and that becomes life. Another theory is that, of course, the stuff was brought in by comets or asteroids or something from coming in from far out, maybe in other solar systems across the void of hundreds of light years or something, and that maybe these chemicals survived and then, you know, kind of populated the Earth. So there's a whole bunch of different theories, but, hey, we don't know.
Right.
Bottom line is, we don't know.
We don't know, but we're trying to find out.
That's right.
Okay, let me ask you this. And you know, for me, again, I'm big on the idea that science is a good thing, and I know that you know, I think there's a big split out there in the public, including Congress, too, over, you know, what's valid and what should be done as far as space exploration and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. What, in your opinion, what would you say should be the top objective for space exploration?
Well, I think there's a couple that are, there are actually about three. One is to find out our place in the universe by finding out something else about the universe.
Right.
You know, like the runaway greenhouse effect is
mm-hmm.
an example. going into space and looking down at our own planet is also very important, because there's observations about our own planet we just can't make unless we're up in space. There's some objection to that politically because, for instance, if we were producing a runaway greenhouse effect, then we probably should do something about it, right? But there's a lot of vested interests who don't want anything to be done about it.
Well, sorry, I think it's something that affects or would affect the very core of our lives on this planet.
Well, it doesn't have to. You see, if it's possible, in my opinion, this is a personal opinion.
Okay.
In my opinion, it's possible to have enough energy without having a runaway greenhouse effect.
So in other words, we can do all this without trashing the planet.
If we conserved, if we controlled population, if we were, you know, used solar energy, et cetera, it'll take a while. There'll be some dislocations. But hey, it costs just, I mean, it provides just as many jobs to build, to make insulation and to make solar electricity as it does to pump oil out of the ground and refine it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter that the vested interests who don't want to change or who see their, you know, way of making money threatened. It's just like John Henry and the steam drill or any of the other times when new ways of doing things have come in and taken over old ways. There's always resistance.
Okay. Okay, let's kind of talk a little bit about politics, because
okay,
that kind of weaves into it. One thing I've been doing, I follow myself the space program with some interest, and something I was curious about, maybe you can help me out with this. But during the Bush administration, Dan Quayle was head of the National Space Council.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have seen nothing talked about since several years ago. What is the equivalent entity under the Clinton administration that's directing national space policy? And basically, what is the administration's attitude about human exploration of Mars?
Well, there isn't a Space Council anymore. There are still the separate agencies, NASA. The military has a far bigger chunk of the space budget now than NASA does. And there is the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which, in fact, I'm from the university. I got my first 2 degrees at the University of Oklahoma, and the guy who's the head of the Office of Space Science and Technology Policy was at Oklahoma the same time I was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know him, but I just thought that was pretty funny. So,
uh-huh.
Hey, Okies rule the world, right? Anyway, so OSTP is supposed to advise the president on all kinds of science policy, and they also do some advising on space. But frankly, this administration, except for Vice President Gore, is not particularly interested in space, and Vice President Gore is primarily interested in Earth observations, which is fine. But there's not a space nut in the administration anymore. Dan Quayle was much more bullish on space than anybody in the current administration.
When you say, Donna, Gore is interested in Earth observation,
mm-hmm,
are you talking about defense-related kind of projects? Or?
Oh, no, he's very concerned about the environment. And
I see.
He's absolutely right, is that we need the Earth Observing System or something like it in order to observe the mm-hmm effects of what people are doing to the planet. And the only way to do that is from space. And so that's his primary interest, and I think that's a fine interest. As far as putting people on Mars, we have to get the space station finished first, because it's just eating NASA's budget. And once the space station is operational, if it's efficient enough so that it doesn't just keep consuming most of NASA's budget, then we could afford to start working on human missions to Mars.
And of course.
In the meantime, we're preparing ourselves by sending robots out as advanced scouts.
I see. Do you think the abolition of the National Space Council had anything at all to do with the increased interest in military applications of space, I guess space exploration, if you could call it that?
Well, no, the military applications, I think, I don't know that there was any connection. I don't see a connection.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, the military was part of the Space Council. They were
It's always
a big
been.
Part.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think abolishing the Space Council was anti-military or pro-military. I think it was just a sign of less interest in space. George Bush was fairly interested in space. He,
mm-hmm,
he made a speech in 1989 saying, we're going to go back to the moon to stay and then on to Mars. And basically Congress just cut out all funding for Mars exploration. In fact, not only do they cut out funding for human Mars exploration, they sort of accidentally cut out funding for robotic Mars exploration. So I recount in the book how I actually had to go do something else for a while.
Okay.
There wasn't any money left to even build tiny little robots to go to Mars.
And, of course, you did a fine job at streamlining it and doing it with a very conservative budget.
Well, me and a lot of other people
right.
who were clever about it.
Okay, Donna, hold on. We're going to take another break. And, of course, when we come back from this break, I'll get some closing thoughts for you from you for our national hour. And then you're going to stay over for our local hour, and we'll continue our interview, okay?
Okay.
Okay, hang on. Donna Shirley is my guest. Again, the book is Managing Martians. Broadway Books publishes it, and in all major bookstores, it's just been published. And as you can tell, Donna's a very interesting person and someone that we can learn a lot about Mars from. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Pilots depend on accurate, timely information, both in the cockpit and on the ground. Skyway Publications helps with both. The Skyway Airport Directory and Entertainment Guide provides convenient, accurate information for safe flight and landing operations, as well as local businesses that cater to pilots. These are free, pocket-sized guides with information on large and small airports nationwide, along with technical information, fuel and airport services, and businesses that can make life easier for pilots. Keep in mind, it's free. Check your local airport for the Skyway Publications Airport Directory and Entertainment Guide, or call area 970-669-1800. Call Skyway today and find out how the guide can also be a financial opportunity for you. Skyway Publications, your ticket to safer, cheaper, and more convenient flight. Check your local airport or call Skyway at 970-669-1800.
Paranet has been on the information superhighway since before there was an internet, and during the last 11 years, we've collected an incredible amount of information on UFOs and the paranormal, and you can see all of it on our website. The address is www.paranet.org/paranet. See what Michael Corbin really looks like. Is he a modern-day Orson Welles? Or go to our news page and keep up with the latest happenings in ufology and the paranormal. Click on other interesting sites from our links page. File a UFO sighting report. Read about Continuum magazine. See the Paranet radio studio. Download free pictures of UFOs. Join Paranet online using your Visa or MasterCard. You'll be authorized within minutes to see all 30 megabytes of files and pictures and nearly 200 real audio files of the Paranet Continuum radio shows dating back to April of 1994. You'll find it all at the Paranet website at www.paranet.org/paranet. The Paranet Continuum is produced by Paranet Information Services, the world's oldest and most respected network of the paranormal. Now back to your host, the director of Paranet, Michael Corbin.
And again, joining me from California is Donna Shirley, and she is the manager of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mars Exploration Program. She's also published a book called Managing Martians. And, Donna, before we go off the air on the National Hour, I want to ask you, everybody seems to have a very big interest in this face on Mars. What is there to that?
Well, you can get on our website at http://mars.jpl.nasa.gov and look at it. Because Mars Global Surveyor, the face is this structure on Mars that Viking got a picture of and had shadows that made it look like it was, to some people, like it was an ancient artifact.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mars Global Surveyor team worked very hard, and they got a very good close-up picture of it a couple of months ago. And it's right there on the website, and everybody's welcome to go look at it. Now, to me and to most people, it looks like an eroded mountain. Unfortunately, it doesn't look artificial at all. And believe me, no one would like more than us to find signs of an ancient civilization on Mars, because think what it would do for our budget.
Sure.
So, unfortunately, this doesn't look like it.
Okay. Now, before we go, one last question, and that is, what is the future, and we have to do this in about 30, 45 seconds, what's the future for Mars exploration?
Okay, we're launching an orbiter in December, a lander in January. The lander's going to land near the South Pole and try to find water. And then we're going to launch two more in 2001, two in 2003. And in 2005, we'll try to launch a sample return to bring a sample back to Earth in 2008.
When do you think we'll put a person on the planet?
Oh, I guess not for a while, because we've got to finish the space station and get it working. So I would say 20 years or so.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us. And you're going to hold over for our local program here in the Denver area. And we'll continue our interview of about your book, Managing Martians. And again, I want to thank you for being on the program. That was Donna Shirley. And she, again, is the manager of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mars Exploration Program. And the book is called, again, Managing Martians. Very interesting. So that's it for us. If you want to reach me, you can do so by contacting me at 303-863-0484. Again, that number is 303-863-0484. My email address is mcorbin@dimensional.com. That's mcorbin@dimensional.com. And, of course, our website, which you must visit definitely, is www.paranetinfo.com. www.paranetinfo.com. And we'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.
Very unusual, to the extent that it looks as if someone was waiting to see whether or not we were taken seriously in our call for live television and for re-photography of the Sidonia region.
Okay.
When it was apparent that they were taking us seriously, that's when it just disappeared.
Okay, give us the numbers now on how to get a hold of your videos and some information.
Well, if you want to follow the progress of this investigation, which now includes two other worlds, you know, the Mars and the Moon, it's 1-800-424-0031. That's 1-800-424-0031. There are a range of videos and books and other materials available. My book, The Monuments of Mars, the video series, which includes the NASA briefings, the UN briefings, the Ohio State briefing on the lunar anomalies that we did last June at Ohio State University, which is 3.5 hours, a two-tape set, which has some pretty interesting images on it. There is, of course, the books by Dr. McDaniel, the McDaniel Report. There are collateral materials by Stan Tenen at the Meru Foundation, material on the investigation of John Anthony West, Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock at Boston University, in terms of the Giza material, the Sphinx, the Giza Plateau, potential tie-ins to our work at Sidonia. There's a wide range of data now to look at, to peruse, to cogitate upon, to consider the alternative foundation to the whole UFO phenomenology, which is that this solar system has been host to a high-tech civilization of no mean capabilities, which has left structures, artifacts, remnants, ruins in disrepair on at least two other worlds that have been photographed now by NASA spacecraft. And someday we're going to be able to tie all this together. That is the ruins and the potential builders of those ruins. But for now, the investigation is trying to proceed with documenting the existence of some pretty awesome and amazing things out there, which for reasons that are currently mostly unknown, the policymakers who control the information flow from NASA do not appear to want us to believe are real.
Okay, Richard, we got a break there. This is the end of the program. Thank you very much for being my guest. We'll have to have you back. It's a very interesting topic, and unfortunately an hour just isn't enough.
It really goes fast.
Okay.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.